Welcome to the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. This program features a series of interviews exploring the origin stories of startup founders, early adopters, and innovation champions related to their personal, technical, business, organizational, and financial journeys. This podcast is sponsored by Astera, the leader in remote Earth observation technology for the water industry. Support is also supplied by Imagine H2O, envisioning and building solutions with the world's best water entrepreneurs, and Aquarius Spectrum, providing advanced fixed-base leak detection solutions to the water utility business. And now, live from beautiful downtown Encinitas, your host, Paul Gagliardo. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. This is episode 20 of the Water Entrepreneur Podcast, and I'm your host, Paul Gagliardo. And today I'm excited to have a good friend of mine, Adam Tank, Chief Customer Officer of Transcend, as my guest, building software to accelerate the design and construction of innovative and sustainable critical infrastructure. Hi, Adam. Thanks for being a water entrepreneur and joining me today.
You bet, Paul. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on the show. I think we're going to have a lot to discuss.
Yeah, well, it's been a while. Remember coming to visit you up in San Francisco and looking at your pipe drone, which is my favorite thing in the world, you know. But
I love it. Yep.
Yeah, everything's going good. You know, when I first joined an engineering design firm almost 20 years ago, I was surprised to find out that most projects were virtually carbon copies of the last one the firm did. You know, that was partially why they were hired, because they had done the type of work before, but the client was still paying for the service as if it was unique. The idea of automating the preliminary design phase of a project using a SaaS platform, I think, is genius. Who are the hardest customers to convince of the value proposition and technical efficacy of the solution? The owners or the design firms?
Design firms, 100%. And we can get into it if you want in terms of who they are and those personas. But suffice to say, Paul, when you're someone that's been designing treatment facilities for your entire career and you're comfortable with your Excel spreadsheets or your own modeling softwares and you understand the intricacies of all of those, for someone to come in and say that their tool can do your job in 1/100th of the time it takes you, and produce the same level of quality and more, there's sort of a reckoning that people have when that happens. And it is a real challenge to get folks to both accept and adopt technology like ours.
So did you go to the customer first and say, hey, you could do it this way and save some money and time? You know, did you fight the big fight with the design firm first and have them pitch it to the customer? You know, was it the cart or the horse first?
The genesis of the tool, it's a pretty cool story, actually, because it was born out of an innovative wastewater treatment company. And at some point, Paul, during the show, we're going to need to discuss my take on innovation in the water sector and how you should actually go about creating a product or service before you've built the thing. Because I think that that's a trap that innovators fall into, is if you build it, they will come. And in our industry, particularly, that's just not the case. For our software, though, we were originally part of a company called Organica Water. And Organica Water has an innovative fixed film membrane system that is used to treat wastewater on a municipal scale. So hundreds of thousands of gallons, if not millions of gallons a day. And they had, at the time in 2012, they had about 30 reference facilities globally, none in North America. We can talk about why that is. It's an interesting market-related challenge. So 30 reference plants. And the challenge that Organica had was their technology worked and it was proven. But when an owner would have an RFP, RFQ that hit the street for a new wastewater treatment plant or even an expansion, and Organica went to bid on those projects, oftentimes the engineering consulting firm sat in between. And what the engineering consultant said was, well, you claim to have this innovative treatment technology that looks like a botanical garden and it doesn't smell and it can be located closer to the center of a city, but prove to me that that's the case. So create a ton of engineering documentation, including the 3D modeling, the BIM files, the PNIDs, the equipment list, the design basis, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours worth of preliminary design documents. And Organica would do this and they'd lose the bid and they were out all the time and effort and money. They couldn't cost recover.
Right.
So the CEO said, well, forget this. We're going to find a way to automate the conceptual design of these plants because it's the only way that I can grow my company without hiring an army of engineers. So it was actually born out of a product company, of an OEM, if you will. And then once the tool was built and Organica started to use it for their own plants, but then also to model competitive technologies, activated sludge, MBR, MBBR, there were consulting firms that said, well, hell, this is actually pretty cool. If I can model what these plants might look like, I can accelerate my time to market in new markets. I can put better proposals out there in front of utilities. I can consider more options earlier on. Basically, I can deliver more value to the utility before this project is even kicked off, and it'll help me be more competitive in the market. And I can shift my resources from preliminary design to detailed design and cost recoverable work. And so in 2019, we spun Transcend out as a standalone software, independent company, raised venture capital, and we've been going to market ever since. To answer your question in a succinct manner, we have found that going to the owners themselves and showcasing the value there and having them present the option or our tool to the consulting firm tends to be the best way to get adoption in the market.
That's interesting. So the cart is before the horse. That's what I would have had expected, because it's so hard to get the old engineer dogs to learn new tricks. And they're, you know, they're in the business of selling hours.
That's right.
And you're saying, well, you got less hours to sell.
Sure.
You know, that's and then go over well with their yeah. profit and loss statements. But so interesting. Yeah. So give me an idea about how it works. You know, what kind of inputs are necessary? What kind of level of design does it get you to? Is it customizable? You know, just give me a little background on it.
Yep. So the tool is, if you think about designing a treatment plant, we'll talk about municipal wastewater for the time being. You know, the engineer's Bible is something called Metcalf and Eddy. Every person that's gone through wastewater engineering is familiar with that textbook.
George Chabonicus.
And if you were to take the rules from that textbook and build a treatment plant based off of it, that is what our base platform is Metcalf and Eddy based treatment plant design. Of course, we have our own set of extremely talented wastewater engineers at Transcend who have configured the tool to be, you know, more unique or more specific to given types of wastewater or for different technologies, et cetera. But at the core, it is a tool based off of Metcalf and Eddy design standard. It's not a black box. So traditional engineering workflow for a wastewater treatment plant starts with a process engineer. And back in your day, Paul, you probably remember, it hasn't changed since. I can almost guarantee you that. Absolutely. You have your process engineers that are looking at selecting and sizing certain equipment, looking at the process. Once they're done, sometimes they'll use tools like BioWin or complex simulation softwares, right? If they're sophisticated. Right. They then pass that data to a mechanical engineer who looks at the equipment and figures out what the equipment is, where it's going to be placed, maybe in a given room. They then pass that to the electrical and controls engineers who figure out the SCADA and ops and everything. And then they pass it to a civil engineer who wraps it all up with a bow on the site. You deliver that to the client. Inevitably, the client says, great, but there's a change. Starts all the way back over at the process engineer. Our software is not that different in terms of workflow, how it works. You start by inputting your influent characteristics. So temperature, BOD, COD, TSS, et cetera, flows. You then choose the technology you want to use to treat the wastewater. It could be a conventional plant, MBR. We're getting ready to launch granular activated sludge in Areta pretty soon. And then you select the site. If you have one, you can put some parameters around how you want the tool to work around existing structures. So it could be used for greenfield or brownfield sites. And then you select the quality of the effluent that you want and you press go. And the design is kicked out a couple of hours later. And it's a complete preliminary design package. So about 30% design for most engineers. The tool, the difference between traditional workflow and what our software does is that in the traditional workflow, you have the process engineers handing over their data to the mechanical, the electrical, electrical, the civil. Our software does the same thing, but it does it all in the cloud seamlessly. So it actually runs a dynamic biological process simulation. It transfers that data to mechanical outputs, to electrical outputs, to civil outputs, and then generates all the documentation in native files. So you'll have a design basis that's created in Microsoft Word based off of a biological simulation. You'll have a Revit file, a BIM model in Revit that you can actually open in Revit and edit. You have a process flow diagram that you can open in AutoCAD. And our software does that automatically. So there's no longer any handoffs across engineers. It's one person entering the data, you press go, and you have the full design package ready for you in a couple of hours.
And so, you know, say you're designing, they selected an MBR system as their treatment technology of choice. Does the package just push out a generic MBR, or can you kind of select, I want to design around xenon or, you know, some other manufacturer? Is it that specific?
Yes. So you can do a generic, or you can do the Z-Weed 500 MBR. I think MemStar is in there today. We have a couple others, again, in the base tool.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes what our enterprise customers will do, so let's take Black & Veatch as an example. They'll actually have specific vendors that they want incorporated into the software so that when the designs come out, not only does it incorporate those specific vendors, but also Black & Veatch's engineering logic. So the way that Black & Veatch might design a treatment plant could be different than a CDM Smith or an AECOM or a Jacobs. And they want their designs to reflect that methodology. Mm-hmm. So part of what we do is have our engineers sit down with theirs. And we'll look at a design and say, how would you do it compared to how our base tool does it? And basically we'll codify that knowledge, if you will, that expertise that B&V has into the software. So when their designs come out in their version of the tool, it's a Black & Veatch design as opposed to a Metcalf and Eddy design or anyone else's design for that matter.
Interesting. That's, I was wondering how flexible that the software has is, and it sounds like it's got some good flexibility in it that, you know, really can relate to the customer as well as to the engineering firm, so they can still have their little tweak. I remember when I was back in the 70s working for Grumman Aerospace Corporation, and everybody was, you know, big Mylar plans and stuff. And speaking of customizing things, the drafts people would always be putting in little Easter eggs in these huge plans. Little cartoons in the corner, you know, this and that, you know.
Yeah, yep.
I mean, it's, you know, they kind of say, come here, let me show you what I did. So to get back to what you, I'm curious as to your take on what I would describe as the process to go from idea to invention to innovation.
Yes.
You know, that's the way I look at
sure.
the innovation world. Maybe you can kind of talk a little bit about that.
Oh, this is like my favorite topic in our industry and in what water entrepreneurs do, and frankly, where I see them flop. So let's use the pipe drone as an example, Paul. So when I worked at GE Water, I got the chance to meet you because we were doing some collaborative work around what ultimately became a FRACTA, really.
Right.
In reality,
right.
It was pipe
right.
assessment, likelihood of failure, et cetera, years before FRACTA ever became a thing. And I will never forget this conversation I had with you where we're talking about leaks in distribution systems. And you were literally slamming on your hand on the table. I won't use the exact verbiage that you did, but you said, I don't need any more damn software to tell me where my leaks are. I need someone that can help me fix them. The cost is not in the leak itself. Water's cheap. The cost is in repairing. It's digging up streets. It's permitting. It's shutting off traffic. It's closing businesses because they don't have water. It's right, all this stuff. So your whole thing was like, if I could only have a robot that would go into my pipes and fix them, you know, that would be brilliant. And so I sort of, you know, stuck that in the back of my head and was like, oh, that sounds good. At the time, I was still right venture capital GE, so I wasn't in an entrepreneurial mindset. Well, when GE announced that Shark Tank style competition, I had to present that as the idea or the concept. And the reason that's such an important story in the way that entrepreneurs should think about going to market is that there's no reason that you need to build the product or service in its entirety, or even a fraction of it, before you try to get buy-in from who you think your ideal customer is. In this case, you at American Water, one of the largest, if not the largest, private utility in the United States, who would have been the ideal customer for something like a pipe drone, you were able to not only tell me that there was demand there, but over time, exactly how that robot needed to function. Take the inverse of that. I could have just sat in a room, raised money, hired a bunch of really smart engineers, developed this thing, a year later brought it to you and said, hey, Paul, look at what I did. You want to buy it? And you'd have gone, hell no. Right? Ultimately, what ended up happening was I went to you, I went to Cliff Chan at EB Mud, I went to the folks at SFPUC, and I said, hey, I have this idea. It's not a thing yet, but here's what I think it should do. Tell me what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically told me the product requirement. You told me the size of pipe it needed to fit in, the type of pipe, the type of bends it needed to make, the type of valves it needed to go through, the price point, how many you would buy, right? The list goes on. You basically had the whole product roadmap for me. So it was easy when I went to investors to say, hey, I need money to build this thing. And this is why. And here are my early customers who are already bought in. By the way, they're the biggest ones in the industry. That to me is the way that innovation should really happen in the sector. You want to build something that people will actually pay for in advance of ever building the thing in the first place.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. As you can describe, I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I still do. Still wish there was some product that could do it, but it'll come. It'll come. I firmly believe that we still have the same set of issues. Nothing's changed. I still work with a lot of different leak detection folks, and you know, we're beating the same dead horse over and over again in the same way, and expecting some different resolution to come out, and you know, it kind of hasn't happened yet.
Right.
You have had quite a varied background. As you mentioned, Suez North America Smart Cities Director, GE Digital Water, and obviously my favorite, you know, the pipe drone company. how'd you get into the water business in the first place?
I'd say like most of us stumbled into it and never left. I was really lucky that Ralph Exton, who was GE Water at the time, just phenomenal guy, an incredible mentor to me, took a flyer on me, quite frankly, out of business school. I didn't have any water industry expertise, but in business school, GE ran a case competition, and it just so happened that one of the people judging it was from GE Water's division, and we won this case competition, and Ralph interviewed me, and he's like, you know what, I've got a position open. You come from a effectively no-name school, University of Arizona, and I'm willing to take a shot. And so my intro to water was at GE Water during grad school, an internship there. And once I graduated, I stayed on full time and I haven't looked back. I mean, it's just, this industry is so hard to ever consider leaving, because you wake up every day and you're working on problems that are important to the whole world. And I, you know, people say that, oh, we're entrepreneurs, right? We're disrupting, or we're changing the industry, or we're blah, this and that, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I can legitimately say the work that we do makes a difference in individual lives every single day. And it's not just the importance of the work we do, but there are so many fun and unique and interesting challenges, market challenges, business challenges, engineering challenges, technology challenges. I mean, our work's cut out for us for the next, you know, 500 years.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of money in the water business, so that doesn't hurt. I know I kind of found myself when I was working for the city of San Diego. I was in public works, then I was in trash, then hazardous waste, and, you know, almost in a serendipitous way, ended up in the water business, you know, solving a problem that that was kind of my role at the city at the time, although I didn't know it. I was the troubleshooter. I always wondered why the city manager would say, hey, would you go work on that, you know, hazardous waste problem? All these people out there are killing me. You know, they're yelling and screaming. You go deal with it. And I'm like, why me? What's, you know? And then, you know, oh, we need you to kind of take over all the groundwater rights in San Diego County. I was like, really? Why me? And when I finally realized that, you know, they needed somebody that, you know, could, one, had the guts, I won't use the word I was going to say, to, and the, you know, the chutzpah to stand up to all these people. And then also the person that if it failed, they just cut my head off and stick me back in the corner.
There you go. Sure.
And if I succeeded, I would let them have all the credit and I would just move on to my next thing. But I've, you know, through that process, found my way into the water business. And as you said, it's, I've never looked back, you know, I'm pushing 30 years doing this stuff. And, there's still a million things to do and a million places to go. And, so yeah, it's really fun. You know, you've worked with big companies, startups, small companies. What role do you like the best?
I love being in front of the customer. I always have been. I like having very real conversations around not only this industry and how to transform it, but the value of products and services in this industry. I feel like we are at a minimum 20 or 30 years behind almost every other major industry when it comes to the adoption of innovation and the way things are done. There are good reasons for that, but I think it's about time that we sort of get our act together and turn the corner. So for me, I enjoy being customer facing because I feel like that's where I can make the biggest impact. And I particularly enjoy conversations when it involves technology because I like to scratch that itch. Mm-hmm. And you see how technology has changed these other industries for the better, radically changed these other industries for the better. And to me, the writing is on the wall in water. We might have a couple more hurdles to go through because it's a public good that people ingest. So obviously we have to make sure that it's safe and we don't screw stuff up. But there are so many ways to, in my opinion, de-risk projects using technology. And we just aren't thinking that way right now. We think that bringing technology in increases risk or opens the door for more risk. And actually, I think it's quite the opposite. So that's what I like to play. I like to be able to sort of poke the stick, right? Poke people and make them think a little differently about how things are done.
You know, my wife and I spent our honeymoon in Rio in 1986. And I know you also spent some time there. It wasn't quite a honeymoon, as I understand it. You know, tell me what you learned, you know, spending some time in the favelas.
Yeah. Oh, it's got so much. So Paul is referencing an article I wrote on my personal blog. Check it out if you want, adamtank.com, about my 23-year-old self getting lost in one of the most dangerous favelas or slums, for lack of a better word, in Rio de Janeiro at the time. What I've learned, and it's, you know, be it living in Rio or I lived in Mexico in college, I have traveled quite extensively, rest of world. And what I find is that people by and large are the same anywhere you go. They want to feel safe. They want to have access to clean water, food, healthcare, education. They want to be happy. They want to be able to live their lives unencumbered from politics or whatever other crap, right, is coming down from the overlord, whoever that might be. And one of the things I learned in Rio was that when I got lost in that favela, I got the chance to meet a street vendor there. And this is a guy who, you know, maybe made two or three USD a day tops. And he was the happiest guy on earth. And what he relayed to me was that even though he doesn't have this unbelievably successful business, and, you know, he lives in a favela in Rio, and, you know, he never went to school and all these things, he was able to support his family who have gone on to do amazing things. So he told me about the stories of his children and the things that they have done. And it was the first time that I really had sort of stepped back and said, man, business can be an avenue to do good in the world. You can make money doing it too, but business can be a way that you can support local communities. You can support society at large. You can be able to give back in what you do day to day. And I found that that's true in the water industry. As we just talked about, we're spending, you know, in a startup, I mean, you're spending 8, 10, 12 to 16 hours a day working on these problems. But it, in many ways, yes, we're here to make a profit, but we're also here to give back. I mean, the reason we do this is because we think that we can have more sustainable infrastructure and we can have better water infrastructure because it's in terrible shape. Something needs to change. And so being able to be mission driven in business leads to a very fulfilling, successful career. And that's what I took away from being in a really tough spot in Brazil.
And I recall my wife and I, you know, walking around on the edges of the bad part of town, up above Ipanema, and not knowing how dangerous the spot we were in.
Mm-hmm.
Because there, you know, on Ipanema, it's, you know, the richest people in town.
Right.
And you go a couple of blocks and it's the poorest people in town.
That's right.
And, you know, there's not much separating everybody.
No.
I loved Rio. I mean, we had a great time.
Yeah, it's an incredible place. And we, you know, at Transcend, we're actually doing a bunch of work in Brazil recently.
Oh, wow.
And it's
been, oh, cool.
Yeah, it's been really cool to see how the Brazilian utilities are thinking about innovation. And I have found that they are far more forward thinking than many of the US utilities, even when it comes to the adoption of new technology, and the way that they procure it is also really fascinating. So I got to tip my hat to the Brazilian water industry, because they're doing some really cool work. They have a long ways to go, don't get me wrong, but they're doing some really cool work.
So I'm going to ask you a question, since the World Cup is going on: Argentina or Brazil?
I got to say Brazil for my customers.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that's fine. I can go with that. You know, looking at your CV and stuff, you talk a lot about teamwork and how important it is in business and in life. Who taught you that lesson? And maybe can you give us some examples of teams you've either been a part of or built, and, you know, what made them special?
Like, if you take two ends of the spectrum in regards to business and entrepreneurship, you've got, on the one hand, we'll call them solopreneurs, or people that are like rogue, basically. They're, you know, maybe one or two person band. They don't really have much of a team. They're running their own show. They're providing a product or service of value, and they're comfortable doing their, you know, in terms of dollars, it could be 50 grand a year, 100 grand a year, 200 grand a year, whatever that might be. On the other hand, you've got a company like General Electric, 100,000 employees or more, where everything is done in teams or by consensus or in a matrixed organization, if you want to use the buzzwords. And the only way to get from the struggling sort of solopreneur, starving artist, to even a moderately successful business, the gap is in people. Yes, processes, yes, systems, but it's all about people. And I learned that really early on. This is another story that I wrote about on my blog, but when I first out of school, I was a microbiologist for General Mills in a food and beverage company. And at 21, having just graduated, I was working in a manufacturing plant that was a 24/7 plant. So three shifts, working overnights, you know, was a hell of an experience. I couldn't stand it. ultimately left, obviously. But one of the things I learned there was I thought that because we were the ones manufacturing the product, that's why General Mills is such a successful food business. Right? If we didn't make the Cheerios, General Mills doesn't exist. And I remember we had a corporate and executive team coming in from Minneapolis, which is headquarters. And they came to the plant and they were trying to launch this new, I think it was like a new yogurt, some type of yogurt line maybe we were working on. And this, you know, corporate sales and marketing guy came in and he's talking about this and that and all these things and how important it is to the importance of sales and marketing. And I didn't even know what sales and marketing was at the time. That wasn't a concept I've ever heard of, right? I was a microbiology geek. And I told him, I'm like, look, I'm here 24/7. We're working three shifts. We're not sleeping at night. We're always dealing with, you know, issues in the plant and, you know, it's always, you know, hair on fire, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And like, this is the reason that General Mills exists. It's because we have such great product. And he was like, dude, you're so wrong. You're so wrong. And he proceeded to very convincingly talk to me about how General Mills is successful for a number of reasons. One of which is that the reason you can sell a box of Cheerios that costs, let's say, 10 cents to manufacture for $3 or $4 on the shelf, that's brand, that's sales, that's marketing. That's why they're successful. And the other part was that he said, if we could find someone else to manufacture this stuff cheaper, better, faster, we'd do it in a heartbeat. Like, you're nothing, basically. Like, go crawl back to your cube and get out of here. And so I came to realize, like, this is an ecosystem. This isn't like, it's not me making the product in a silo in the manufacturing plant. And frankly, it's not him selling or marketing it in a silo. This is it's an organism, and it takes on a life of its own. And the reason that it works, his reasons obviously were prime, but is because there are people that are all making this happen. And so when I've built members of the team, either with a robotics drone company or here at Transcend, we've gone from 12 people in 2019 to 65 today. So three years later, it's been the caliber of the people that have made all the difference. And so that's what I try to focus on, is attracting, retaining, and promoting really good talent.
So are you involved in recruiting?
Yes, you bet. And I mean, even stuff like this, in theory, is a way to recruit. I hope that people listen to this. And even if they don't join Transcend or you're even interested in anything I have to say, we're at least elevating the caliber of the conversation around water and hopefully attracting people who have never thought about a career in water. But also the fact that you can do a lot of cool stuff. There's so much cool stuff to do. You want to, like, if you want to talk about the sexy, right, cutting edge stuff, the big data and analytics, the AI, the automation, that's all happening. And we're still super early days. So if you're someone that is tech minded, the water industry is a great place to be. If you're also someone that's public policy minded, a lot of cool policy work going on. If you're someone who's interested in sustainability, tons of cool work around natural solutions, natural capital, carbon footprint, that's all happening now. It's all happening in the water industry. So yes, absolutely. Recruiting both for myself, but also for the industry at large.
And that is a part of what I kind of view this part of the podcast as, a virtual mentoring platform, you know, where people can hear the stories of others who have been there, you know, give them, you know, I want to call it advice, but information about what this business is about, and hopefully bring more people to the fold, because I think it's hugely important. And as you mentioned, there is opportunity for almost any function, any kind of, you know, specialty you want to have, you can find it in the water business.
Yes.
And it's just a fabulous business to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I also know that you volunteer in prisons. Tell me, you know, what was the reason you started that important work?
So I believe I have an obligation, and I think we as members of society who have been given the opportunities to succeed we have an obligation to give back. And one of the ways I enjoy doing that is by teaching and mentoring people. And I had a close friend in undergrad who, his name's Naeem Al-Amin. Any, maybe, you know, in the podcast notes or whatever, I can drop you a link to the cool work he's doing. But he was someone who, I mean, you couldn't have found two more opposite people to be located in a college in the middle of Kansas. Myself, you know, a white kid from the suburbs of Kansas City. Naeem, a black guy from the hood, from Crenshaw in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Who was a part of some serious gang activity and had been in prison. We both graduated. I looked him up a couple years later and I found out that he was back in prison. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked because he was one of the most incredible people I'd ever met. And it was in that moment, and I don't know if I went out and looked for it or somehow it just fell into my lap, but there was an organization in California called Defy Ventures who helps folks who are currently and formerly incarcerated start their own businesses and become entrepreneurs. Or at least help get them on their feet once they are reintroduced. And so I thought about Naeem and I thought, God, here's a guy who could literally take on the world if he just had someone in his corner. I can't do that for him now, but maybe I can do it for others. So I started volunteering with Defy and the rest is history. I'm happy to say that Naeem is now incredibly successful. He's a phenomenal entrepreneur. He's doing really well now. But again, the importance of giving back is critical, and it doesn't need to be in prisons. It doesn't need to be, you know, doing anything wild, but just take some time to give back one way or another. Life's too short. Like you gotta put some good out into the world. And I find that it comes back your way tenfold. Not that that's a reason to do it, but typically you put good things out there, good things happen.
Well, karma is very important. I know my wife has started to help, you know, Mexican nationals pass their test to become citizens. Mm. So she mentors one person at a time and, kind of goes through, 4 or 5 months of, going through the questions, kind of building them up, working with them. And, so far, and she's very excited about learning Spanish, doing all those kind of things. So far she's got 100% hit rate, every one of her students has passed. So
that's great.
And that's exactly her feeling. She's like, I feel like, she says, I feel like I need to give back to society just in general. I have time. I'm in a place where I can do it. And so that's something that she has taken on, and I'm real proud of her about that.
That's amazing.
What advice would you give somebody who's considering either working in the water business or starting up a company in the water business? What kind of things have you learned that maybe you didn't know when you first started? We've talked about, obviously, you would recommend people get into this business, but, give me some ideas or give our listeners some ideas about the kinds of things they should think about.
The first I would say is don't overthink it. So just do it. If you're someone who's been sitting there thinking, God, should I start a company? Should I sort of step out on my own or maybe even join a startup? Just do it. You can always go back to the big corporate role. There's always, especially in the water industry, there are always positions to be had, in places that are a little more conservative or slow moving. Those can be had. The second thing I would say is your baby. What I mean by baby is the thing that you're planning to build or create is probably uglier than you think it is. And it's better to have somebody tell you that very early than it is to find out after you've spent hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, either of your own money, your fans, friends and family, or investors' money, and a big team of people to then have to close up shop because the thing sucks, truth be told. So similar to what we talked about earlier on, Paul, go to the people that you think are going to be your best customers and pitch the idea in front of them and have them tell you all the reasons why it's not going to work or they wouldn't buy, et cetera. Try to get them to sign an LOI or MOU in advance of you building the thing. And it's going to tell you two things. The first is, how good are you at selling? Can you even get in front of the Paul Gagliardo at American Water? That's the first.
It's important.
Which is its own challenge. Secondly, will he buy that thing that you're planning on building if you haven't already built it? And that's a whole another can of worms. So make a list of your top customers, your top prospects. Think about the ones that you, that in an ideal world, you say, my product or service is best fit for this person for this reason, and this is the value that it will create for them, and then go and pitch them on it and see what they have to say. Do that before you do anything else, because you're going to save yourself a hell of a lot of heartache.
That's good advice. That's good advice. Well, this was certainly a fun, far-ranging conversation. It's so great to see you and talk to you again. I'm so glad you're doing well, and I wish you all the best of luck with the company.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks for putting on the show.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Astera, with additional support from Imagine H2O and Aquarius Spectrum. The producer is Anna Gagliardo. Theme music by Gabriella Gagliardo. Yes, this is a family affair. Your host is Paul Gagliardo. If you have any questions about this podcast or the series, please contact us at thewaterentrepreneur@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram. We hope to see you all again next time. We'll be right back.